Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
Hello, I'm Steve Evans. Welcome to Business Daily. In the programme today, how hot air from your computer might stifle the planet.
2% of all the power generated in the US is used in data centres, and those data centres are growing at an explosive rate.
And why you have a duty to stop your boss twittering on about Twitter, or is it twittering on about Twitter?
I recently met a British business leader who complained that he was now so focused on turning the details of his day into pithy tweets that he was finding it hard to pay attention to what he was doing.
Lucy Kellaway and lots more good sense in Business Daily from the BBC. Now, in December, politicians and no doubt protesters from 120 countries meet in Copenhagen to thrash out a successor to the Kyoto Protocol, which expires in 2012. This great splurge of air miles will be a place for the big and important arguments. But we've decided to look as well at some of the less glamorous micro ideas, those small improvements by gradation that might add up to big change. First then, let's take computers, which eat energy, not just on your desk, but in the vast data centres. One idea is called virtualization, and what this ghastly jargon means is getting bigger computers to work flat out doing the computing that lots of computers now do separately. The result, according to Robin Johnson, the chief information officer of Dell, would be a big, big saving in electricity.
2% of all the power generated in the US is used in data centres, and those data centres are growing at an explosive rate. But then you drill down a level and you look at how much of a server's or a machine's capacity is actually used on useful workload. And the industry would tell you that's between 18 and 22, 23%.
So the rest of it is just keeping the machine going.
Exactly. So the key question, and the thing we've been working on, is how do I utilise that remaining 80%?
Go on.
About 3 years ago, we were faced with the challenge of building a new data centre, which is about $200 to $300 million of spending. And when we looked at that decision, really we tried to find a smarter way of running the enterprise. And that smarter way was really to what's termed a virtualize our machines, so put multiple workloads on a single server and use some of that excess capacity to run different workloads, therefore consolidating the number of servers. Now, that consolidation not only saves us money, it saved us so far about $38 million, but it also means we need fewer square foot, therefore fewer data centers. And I think the big thing, you know, we've set ourselves out to try and be the greenest IT company out there. And the other big thing it does for you, the biggest cost in terms of running IT now is becoming power. Power to both power up the infrastructure and heat and cooling in the data centres. It radically reduces the amount of power we use in our data centres.
So what's the essence of that idea, do you say?
If you look at the use of, say, industry standard platforms, so regular PCs, as opposed to the old mainframes, the innovation that's come in that market is around multiple workloads running on a single machine. And I would say the ability to automatically set up a machine rather than doing it manually. So if you think of your home machine when you install software, the ability to automate that process. So reducing both the labor and the hardware cost as a percentage of the overall IT expenditure.
Dell is making these ventures, saying it's the greenest computer company on the planet, all that kind of thing. But actually, the commercial reality is that Dell is very much on the back foot because the competition is now absolutely massive. And you led the world 10 years ago, and now you don't. How are you going to turn that around?
Well, I don't think it's any secret that we're making a huge move into the services space. And to your comment on the overall market, actually, you know, if you look at all the benchmarks that the industry use to really regulate how efficient the infrastructure is, we're winning multiple awards. We're ahead of the competition in that. Now, we absolutely are trying to make the transition.
Do you know the award that counts? Share price. Yours is going down.
As I say, we're in a transition to a services company. Now, those transitions are always difficult. Yeah, we absolutely have a good, sustainable hardware business. You know, we need to grow the services business that many of our competitors have had multiple years in it. I think the point of the story, how do you regain that position? We need to develop services in a different way to been delivered in the past. So we're not here pushing build a new data center, buy more equipment. We're here pushing very different ways of delivering IT technology in both a socially responsible fashion and a cost-conscious fashion.
How does a company with a great reputation, how do you compete when now the cost is just falling through the floor? Niche and brand used to matter, but now the ease of entry, well, is very easy. It's easier to get into this market now. How do you compete?
I think you find new values. If you talk to most CIOs, especially in a downturn, the fundamental problem is, how do I maintain my spending on creating new business value? And if you go to Gartner or Forrester, most of the research firms in the IT business, they would tell you about 70% of an IT department's spending is on fixed cost. So it's running what they already have. So the challenge for CIOs is, how do I run my infrastructure more efficiently? How do I use those savings and push that into the development side of the house and create new value, cost savings, revenue increase, margin, new products on for the business?
And that was Robin Johnson of Dell. Now, in all this, there's often a focus on big picture demands for a switch from carbon fuels to alternative energy sources like wind and tide and solar. But are the economics of these alternative non-nuclear energy sources actually improving? One of the world's big makers of solar power equipment is the Indian company Bosa Mayer. I asked its chief financial officer, Yogesh Mathur, if solar power was now becoming doable.
Clearly, the answer is a resounding yes. And I think there are two, three key reasons for that. One is that the global industrial and energy environment is shifting in terms of requirements and demands to emerging economies. The emerging economies are all hungry for power. Their key security concern on energy is just having power. And because of growth rates, one of the key factors which gets more pronounced is actually peaking energy. And if you really come to it, then meeting the demand for peaking energy right at the point of consumption is exactly what solar energy is suited for. And as costs decline quite sharply the way they have been over the last year or two, it's starting to become an economical source of peaking energy, eminently suited to meet the needs of emerging markets and still relevant and still strongly relevant now and going forward when it comes to meeting the environmental challenges that are satisfied by renewable energy.
And by peaking energy, you mean that little bit of extra energy that a country or a community might need above the base, which might be provided by coal or nuclear or hydro or whatever.
Yeah, well, even more specifically, it's about the fact that human activity peaks in the middle of the day, typically during the day, industrial activity included, and agricultural activity as well. And hence, the power requirement at peak is significantly higher than it is, you know, on an average. And when you see that in the context of growing economies, that peak becomes more pronounced. And the cost of peaking energy is typically 50 to 80% higher than the cost of the typical base load. So let's say base load is 10 cents. Then you would have maybe 15 to 18 cents as the cost of satisfying the peak requirement. And you have solar energy costs today starting to touch the 20 cent level or the 20 to 25 cent level, given the significant decline in costs in the last 6 to 9 months, as well as the fact that in a lot of these emerging economies such as ours, as well as other parts of the world, the level of so-called solar insulation is actually significantly higher than the average too.
So solar becomes something which takes up that extra demand but is not doable for the main burden, as it were, because the costs are still too high?
Well, is not currently doable, but is emerging as a distinct possibility because a lot of the existing technology, the silicon-based technology, as well as a number of the emerging and industrializing technologies are clearly those that are set to have the potential to reach what we call grid parity, which is the parity with the average cost of power from the grid. And then at that time, you would then have solar being able to generate and, you know, to the extent you generate and consume immediately through the grid, you would have a source that actually satisfies base load as well.
So when might we get to that situation on this planet
and how might we get to it, where solar becomes a viable technology in the sense that coal is or hydro is or whatever?
Well, you see it as viable, supported by subsidies and tariffs such as exist out there for grid-connected systems. You see that today. You see it as fairly attractive because it's backed by government. And it's once installed, has a 20 to 25-year life of generation, and therefore is very interesting from a financial standpoint. Looking at the way these technologies are evolving across all of these technologies, you see today, maybe within a year or so, you start to see it as clearly competitive without subsidies in terms of peaking power cost. So that's the 15 to 18, 15 to 20 cent type of power cost levels. And I would say another couple of years beyond that, you know, it could start to be grid competitive.
Yogesh Mathur, send your thoughts to world.business@bbc.co.uk. And you're listening to Business Daily from the BBC with Steve Evans. From the corporate then to the personal, how might individuals, people, you and me, do our bit? In Western Europe and North America, there's a focus on food miles, on cutting the distance from farm to fork, as it's put. But the idea has been dented by studies showing that making food in ideal but distant places can offset the energy used in transportation. New Zealand lamb in Britain comes to mind. And if you're a Californian who likes rice, for example, you might do better by the planet to buy imported Bangladeshi rice done without expensive irrigation schemes. In other words, then, there aren't easy answers. So, are food miles nonsense? It's a question I put to James Walton, the chief economist of IGD, which represents the food and grocery businesses in Britain.
It's not necessarily nonsense. What I would say is that, first of all, local food is not just about the carbon footprint. It's not just about the fuel consumed. It's about offering range. So if you can offer a local product that has specific tastes or flavours or textures that nobody else can, then that's a good enough reason to offer it. Coming to the carbon footprint specifically, of course, this is extremely important. We know that food production is a major contributor to greenhouse gas production. One of the things that we've done at IGD to try and address this is we've worked with a number of other organisations, including the British Standards Institute, to come up with something called PAS 2050, P-A-S 2050. And that is the world's first protocol for measuring the carbon footprint of a particular product or a particular service from the start of the supply chain to the end. So at least what we can do now is we now have a common set of tools, we have and have a common language for talking about the carbon which is embedded within a product. And we're starting now to develop a body of evidence. It's very, very early days. However, the studies that we've seen so far suggest that the case for local food as a solution to climate change is probably not yet made. As you say, in many cases, particular products can actually be produced elsewhere in the world, brought to the UK with lower carbon footprint than we can produce them for here in the UK. And that, I suppose, is a good reason for importing. But what we've seen over the years is that naturally, production of products tends to migrate to the places where it can be done most efficiently. And historically, most sourcing decisions have been made based upon cash efficiency. Where is it cheapest to produce this? But now, of course, we recognise that carbon is almost a currency in itself. So what we'll see is increasingly over time, sourcing decisions made not only where is it cheapest, but also where is it most carbon efficient to get this particular product from.
James Walton. Now, on Business Daily, we do not tweet, nor do we Twitter. We take the view that new technology is fab, of course, but the really smart thing to do is to use it sparingly. But Twitter is one of the fastest growing websites. If you get involved, you can send a message of up to 140 characters to your followers, informing them of what you're doing, having a sandwich, let's say. But even though Twitter is phenomenally fast growing, it's not clear how profitable it might be. Users do not a bottom line make. Lucy Kellaway is not a great fan, particularly of executives who've discovered it like it's the new dance craze for young people.
Not long ago, Adam Brown, the head of digital communications at Coca-Cola, got his car washed and the sun shone down on him in Atlanta. Meanwhile, Bart Cass, his opposite number at Pepsi, went for a run on the Brooklyn Bridge. I happen to know these details because I've stumbled upon Exec Tweets, a collection of about 100 executives who like to express themselves in chunks of up to 140 characters on the Twitter website. Thus, I've come to be a disciple of Bart and Adam, but I like Bart best. One tweet goes like this. Worked late, woke up feeling tired, but driven forward by the many exciting possibilities a new day brings. Seize the day. An earlier one says, got home. My son told me he loved me. My daughter was as precious as ever. Suddenly the wind was at my back again. Twitter so far is not proving a good place for executives who are making a complete hash of using it. Either they fill it with mundane personal detail or they fill it with mundane professional detail, which is even worse. The first scores higher on embarrassment, the second on tedium. Jeffrey Hazler, Chief Marketing Officer of Kodak, reports hour by hour on just how he is spending his day at work. Here's a typical tweet. Now meeting with the Kodak marketing team for lunch to talk about general items and to get to meet the team. To meet the team in order to meet the team doesn't seem like something that people who follow him will really need to know. An even more tiresome category of businessman uses Twitter to boast. Sir Richard Branson is a leader here. Honoured, my blog has been nominated for a prestigious Webby Award for Business Blog. Check it out, he says in one post. Despite the dismal use to which executives are putting Twitter, more and more are signing up for fear of being left behind. I recently met a British business leader who told me that he had just joined, but complained that he was now so focused on turning the details of his day into pithy tweets that he was finding it hard to pay attention to what he was doing. Worse, once he'd composed his tweets, he felt insecure and unpopular, as only three people seemed to be following him. Yet despite this unpromising start, it seems to me that services like Twitter are ideal for corporate communications. Indeed, I can't see why it can't replace email altogether, which has so clogged up the inboxes of office workers that very little real work is getting done. To force everyone to say what they have to say in 140 characters would deal with a communications overload at a stroke. Not only would messages be quicker to read and easier to understand, most would not get sent at all. The bulk of internal emails are exercises in back covering or throat clearing, and so if they were forced down to their barest essentials, it would become clear that there was nothing there that was worth saying in the first place. This is Lucy Kellaway for the BBC World Service.
How do top executives have the time to twit, as it were? Do they not have proper work to do? The Steam email address is world.business@bbc.co.uk. The web address is bbcworldservice.com.
There's a BBC podcast for every area of business.
I'm Roger Hearing with the latest business news from the BBC.
From today's world business news to global trends with Peter Day.
So I've made a trip to the new China to see what impact credit crunch is having here.
And from the top of the morning.
Welcome to Wake Up to Money with Mickey Clark.
Hello, I'm Leslie Kerwin. Welcome to Business Daily.
To the bottom line.
Who makes money when boom turns to bust?
Download your choice of BBC business podcasts at bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.